I am Peter Schaefer on behalf of the appellants. My bar ID number is 5255. Good morning again, and may it please the court. To begin with, would it please the court to hear a recitation of the facts as they were included in the briefing below?
I think you can assume we have a command of the facts. Just touch on the ones that you think are relevant to your claims of error below.
Your Honor, I'm not here. Your Honors, I'm not here today to argue vague and ambiguous terms in the contract specified in the briefing below as controlling this issue. Those contracts are the Declaration of Covenants and Code of Regulations governing a condominium complex in which the appellants, my clients, the Bennetts, own a unit. What I'm arguing here today and what I argued in the briefs to this court and the briefs below is that there are many, many, many specific phrases in these controlling documents specifically stating that my clients are entitled to insurance coverage through the condominium complex, meaning insurance coverage paid not by them privately, but by the homeowner association dues that are required to be paid monthly.
I understand this, how this got here procedurally, but tell me, is there any evidence in the record of the condominium complex insurance policy itself? Is the policy in the record?
Yes, I believe it is. I believe the entire policy was put in by the matter below by Philadelphia Indemnity Insurance Company's answering brief, and I believe they included almost 1,000-page comprehensive liability policy.
And it covers the contents of the units?
It does. In the rear of the policy, it states that if the controlling documents of the condominium say that unit owners are covered as to their personally owned property, meaning both real estate and personalty, then the Philadelphia Indemnity Insurance coverage does indeed cover them.
I don't understand that. It either covers or it doesn't. Somebody has to pay a premium based on coverage or non-coverage. How would that work?
Well, it is
a contingent coverage.
The policy is a commercial policy which consists of many forms developed over the year and is commonly referred to as boilerplate. And the provision in there saying that if the condominium documents, the Declaration of Covenants and the Code of Regulation indicate that unit owners are also covered as to their privately owned property, then yes, this policy does indeed cover them. But that would affect the underwriting process where they estimated the premium. They say, are you covered? Yes. Okay, the premium is going to be higher, therefore.
Right. And does the record show whether the premium that was charged and paid in this case is consistent with coverage of units and contents thereof?
That fact was not argued.
Or only the common elements?
That fact was not argued or explored, or there was no discovery on that issue either way, Your Honor.
Well, putting aside the admissibility of offers of settlement, the record does show that at least the policy for the condo complex entered into some type of settlement negotiations. They fell through, but it would seem to indicate they thought there was some exposure. You started by saying you didn't want to talk about ambiguity, but to the extent there are inconsistent or ambiguous terms, then we look at the intent of the parties, and it would be fairly probative to know if somebody thought the documents required them to purchase insurance.
That point was brought up in argument two of my opening brief and also in my reply brief, Your Honor. And basically what I said is that all parties at all times during the point where there was damage to my clients, the appellant's units, up to a second adjustment on that, all parties involved in this, which would be the Bennetts, the downstairs neighbor Cal Gross, who owned a unit that was also damaged, the Homeowners Association, the Plantation Seats Condominium Association, the property manager who managed that property for them, the insurance company, Philadelphia Indemnity Insurance Company, all behaved as if there were insurance covering these losses up to the point of issuing a check. And it was only when
you say these losses, that's why we're here. What losses were covered? So no one disputes, I take it, that there wasn't a loss. The scope of the coverage is the issue here.
In the adjustment, which is part of the record below, that was done by, I believe it was McHenry Adjusters, who was hired by Philadelphia Indemnity Insurance Company. They presented to the condominium complex, who was in privity of contract with the insurance company, a very detailed estimate of the losses, which included items that were specifically not common elements, nor even limited common elements, but structures and items inside a condominium, which are typically considered to be privately owned property, either real estate or personalty. And that was covered under the original adjustment. So it was not just the original check.
When you say adjustment, you mean an estimate of damage?
Of course, yes, Your Honor, appraisal estimate, yes.
And that's significant in relation to coverage? How?
Well, this would be significant to Justice Holland's point as to if the parties behaved at all times, that the coverage did indeed include the personal property owned by my clients.
But the estimator is not a party. The parties we're talking about here are the insurance carrier, the condominium association, and the unit holder.
And, of course, the manager.
That is what the estimator estimated in terms of total damage. Mm-hmm. Speak to the position being taken at any point in time by the three parties in interest.
If one of those parties in interest instructed an agent, the adjuster, to go in and say, determine the extent of the damages here and include in the extent of the damages personally owned property of the unit owners, that would clearly indicate that everyone thought, the party in interest in their agent, the adjuster, that this insurance did indeed cover personal property.
Well, I'm not sure I understand why that would clearly make that so. We know there's a loss. The estimator has no interest in who indemnifies whom for that loss. They only want to know what was lost and what would be the cost of the indemnification. At a later time, people sort through who pays for what, if at all, based on the coverage that they believe they must honor as a matter of law, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And but the logical starting point would be to know what the total damages are. Then you parse out who owes whom what. So when does it become, in the record as you understand it, clear to all of the parties that there's no dispute about who indemnifies whom for what amount?
When the check was issued based on the appraised damages. And if the adjuster goes in not knowing what items are covered and what is not and hands in an estimate showing damage to everything in there and the insurance company writes a check covering everything in there, that would de facto include privately owned property as well as the condominium.
As a matter of fact here, does the record show that the insurance carrier wrote a check for all the estimated damages, including the unit's losses along with its contents?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is the insurance carrier a real an indispensable party here, because they're not a party, are they?
They are not a party to this appeal. This appeal is whether
they're not a party to the action.
They're correct.
So are we adjudicating whether there's coverage under this policy somehow?
No, Your Honor. I believe more specifically we are adjudicating whether or not the condominium controlling documents, as well as the behavior of parties, indicate that there should be insurance. If there's not, that there should be. And if there is, pay it.
Okay, and if there's not, then basically the condominium association is liable for that breach, and ultimately your client will pay a share of the damages for failure to procure insurance?
That is true, but the share will be de minimis compared to what they would get for the entire amount they should have received in repairing their condominium. So if it's split, I think I see Your Honor's point that they would be paying this one way or another. If they were paying a share due to breach by the condominium government, it would be a share split up among hundreds of unit owners, in return for which they would receive a check for many thousands of dollars for repair of damage to their real property and personal property.
Now I'm really confused, because I thought you had just argued to us that it's plain under the language of the condominium association's documents that they were obligated to provide insurance coverage for this. There was insurance coverage, and that the insurance carrier admitted there was coverage and wrote a check for the damage. If that's all true, why are we here?
The matter exploded. The dispute began when a competing estimate for damages far exceeding the original adjustment amount was submitted. And even though the parties all the way through this process behaved as if there was insurance, getting adjusters, cutting a check, holding a check by the condominium association, as they're the named insured under the policy. When the amount of the check was disputed, there was a 180-degree turnaround, and the appellants, or excuse me, the appellees, defendants below, said, oh, wait a minute, we made a mistake. There is no insurance at all, which is
sort of... Tell us the exact numbers. What was the check for? How much was the check for?
It is in my brief. I believe it was slightly more than $24,000.
And what was the higher estimate?
There were two units damaged, the appellant's unit, which is upstairs, and Carol Gross was a third-party plaintiff below. Her estimate was $80,000 for her unit alone, and 3 years ago, the upstairs unit was approximately $50,000 in damages.
So we get to the point where the check is tendered for $24,000 that would include damage to the unit, but the unit holders come back and they say, well, it's really $130,000. And then the insurance company says, well, not only are we not giving you the check, we're taking the position there's no coverage.
Not the insurance company, Your Honor. The insurance company never took that position prior to the dispute.
The condominium association.
Correct. They're the ones who said, wait a minute, that disparity in dollar amounts, we don't want to argue that because we've all of a sudden decided after months of negotiation and even a check being tendered showing insurance coverage that there's no insurance at all.
And that's based on their reading of their own condominium documents.
I don't mean to be glib, but evidently they read it twice with a 180-degree meaning each time, the first time saying there is and the second time saying there isn't insurance.
I understand, but it brings me back to Justice Jacobs' earlier question, supplemented by my question about ambiguity. You told us that the policy says if the condominium documents say there's coverage, then there's coverage.
Correct.
And the question is, that seems a little confusing that you either bought coverage or you didn't, or they were buying it as a contingency in case this court would hold that the condominium documents required insurance. But this is a motion for summary judgment, and it would seem to me that it would be important to know in the record if they thought they were really buying coverage or not.
I'm sorry, I'm a little bit confused. When on the pronoun they were buying coverage by they?
The condominium complex. You know, Justice Jacobs' question was you compute the premium, you know what your exposure is. And what we don't know in the record is whether the insurance company really thought it was undertaking a substantial risk based on what the document said, or it was going to wait until something happened and then something like this lawsuit was decided. It seems like a very, very unusual way to do things, and it seems even more unusual to do it on summary judgment.
I think the summary judgment could be interpreted as being appropriate below because the facts are few and more undisputed up to the point of suit.
Isn't it correct that the trial judge held as a matter of law that the condominium documents required the association to purchase insurance for the common areas, but did not mandate that they do so for the units and the unit contents, but they had the discretion to expand the insurance coverage to include the units and the unit contents. And as a result, dismissed the claim beyond indemnification for damage to the common areas.
As to the first holding, Your Honor, yes, I agree with that, that the court below did find that there was no obligation nor any coverage of anything but common elements and perhaps even limited common elements.
Well, maybe then you should tell us exactly why you believe that is an incorrect or erroneous holding.
I would like to recite from the contracts in effect governing this insurance issue, which are the Declaration of Condominium and the Code of Regulations promulgated under the authority of the Recorded Declaration of Condominium. Article 15A of the Declarations states insurance should cover common elements and buildings, fixtures, personal property, et cetera, et cetera. The Code of Regulations, Section 6E, specifies insurance coverage for property with a capital P. Property is clearly defined in the Declaration of Covenants as including units with a capital U, which is privately owned property. Code Regulation 6E again, if damage, and I quote, if damage is to both common elements and units, why would it specify damage to units, which are defined as personal property, if it had no intention of providing insurance on such units?
Well, one could assume that it would be defining the scope of the coverage if it had been purchased, and if there were a provision that mandated that insurance be purchased beyond casualty insurance for the common areas. That's the real question, not what the document says if you had purchased the insurance, but something that says you are mandated to purchase insurance that would cover the units and their contents.
It says that in Article of Declaration of Condominium, Article 15A, Sections 1 and 2, and it specifies you must buy insurance, not only property casualty, but also liability insurance.
If it's that obvious, how did the trial judge make a mistake?
I'm at a loss to explain that, Your Honor. Well, and didn't the trial judge
in essence say that what you're proposing is not the way condominium associations and the whole holding property in that fashion, that's just not the way it works, that the common areas are what's covered by the condominium association and each unit owner acts as if it's his own home and gets whatever coverage he or she wants for the space inside of that home. And that, you know, that is the only way that insurance coverage ever works with condominiums.
And that contention is flatly contradicted by Title 25, Chapter 81, as most recently amended in 2009. Which it doesn't cover our case, according to the Chancery Court holding in Village of Cinderbury. However, the replacement of Uniform Property Act, the new Chapter 81 in Title 25, specifically says that if units abut each other, any insurance covering common elements must also cover these units. It's mandatory. So in other words, the common sense scheme that there's no way a condominium association could provide insurance not only for common elements but private property is flatly contradicted by the Delaware statute.
Mr. Schaefer, going back to the Chief Justice's question, which posits, and I think correctly, that the trial judge held that there was nothing in the documents, the condominium documents, that required the association to purchase property and casualty coverage for the units, but the association could do that if it chose to do it as a matter of discretion. One question would be whether the record shows that the association did in fact do that as a matter of discretion, and that would turn on whether the premium that they paid was a premium that actuarially would cover both the common elements and the units as well. But we don't know that one way or the other, do we? That is it is the record doesn't show that.
Correct, Your Honor. That was neither used to promote our position, nor was it used to defend by the other side that, you know, this premium is obviously too insufficient to cover the risk presented by my side.
Let me refine the question. Was the record developed so that if somebody were looking for that information, they could find it? Or
no, Your Honor.
All right.
And if I might add, Your Honor, to that question, deconstructing an actuarial estimation of a condo unit that size to determine whether that the discovery would be incredible and I think burdensome, Your Honor.
Well, but let's put the premium differential cost aside. If indeed, as you've already argued to us, there's evidence in the record that the parties at some point in time had the expectation that the coverage was there and that it was a form commercial policy which included references to the units as being insured properties in addition to the common areas, why wouldn't an exploration of the record on that issue is, well, you had the discretion to purchase it, and you did. It was there. It was available.
As I mentioned in the reply brief, under the Delaware statute, not Chapter 81, but the older UPA Act, case law specifically says that you basically have the freedom, if you submit to the Texas Delaware Code, you can contract for whatever you want. And our position is they did indeed contract. They contracted to provide insurance based on the plain reading of the language requiring reporting requirements if you improve your unit, et cetera, et cetera.
I'm
missing the point. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I understand that argument, but touching on Justice Jacobs' question, just putting the differential between premiums aside as evidence that there was extra coverage purchased, as I understood your argument, you were saying the coverage was there. The policy said the unit was covered. The original estimate assumed that it would be estimating what would be in a loss that would be indemnified. The parties acted at all times consistently with that until the second estimate came in and was so high that people balked at paying it. Whether that was for the reason of not being covered or just because it was too high an estimate, who knows? But there was never any exploration here of whether coverage actually existed or not. There was simply a decision by the trial judge that as a matter of law, purchasing it was discretionary and not mandated, therefore summary judgment to the defendant, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. Excuse me, correct, Your Honor.
Okay, you have 3 minutes and 30 seconds. Did you want to save it for rebuttal?
I would like to, Your Honor. Thank you. May I be seated?
Yes.
Good morning. William Caddy for the appellees. In listening to the questions, if I may just procedurally say how the record appears at this time. There was the flood. The Bennetts came in to the Wilgus office at the direction of their unit insurance company, USAA, to get information. The property manager, Julie Banks, was on vacation. Now, she's testified that she manages 10 condominiums and that she's had a number of flood cases, mostly with appliances, lines that go into ice makers and things like that, breaking and flooding units and adjoining units. Her testimony, which is part of my brief, is that she never submits those claims to the condominium insurance. She submits them to the unit insurance. If she had been there, this claim probably never would have been submitted to Philadelphia. And that's the position and the reason why Plantations and Wilgus is taking this position, is that that's her experience and that's how the insurance is set up. And Judge Bradley agreed that that is the way the insurance usually works at condominium associations. If you look at the documents, you will see very specifically that if there is a loss to the condominium development caused by a defect in a unit, the unit owner is responsible for those repairs. They have to repair the common unit, the common areas, and they have to repair any damage they do to another unit. That's explicit in these agreements. What the plaintiffs are trying to argue is that by convolution of looking at other documents, that the association agreed to purchase not only liability but also casualty insurance for their unit. And it's not spelled out anywhere. The statute at the time made it discretionary. And so on the one hand, we have this explicit language that says the unit owners are liable if they cause damage. And over here, we have no explicit undertaking to purchase insurance.
Except for liability insurance.
Liability insurance if it arises out of the common elements. There's a restriction on that in the language. It is not general. And I gave examples that if somebody came into your unit and tripped and fell in the common area, then you would be covered by the association's policy for liability coverage. But if they sat down in a chair that you owned in your unit and it broke, then that's your unit owner policy. And there are circumstances where you can have it that it would work out that maybe both policies got triggered, and then you look at the other insurance provision in the policy.
I'm confused procedurally here. we all agree that it certainly was permissible for the condominium association to have purchased insurance that would have covered the personal property and interior of the units, right?
That is correct.
Okay. So one question would be, as I understand appellant is putting it, was there anything in the condominium association documents that required that? Let's assume for a moment that there was nothing that required the purchase of that insurance. So now we're down to whether they were required or not. Is the insurance that they purchased insurance that covers this this damage? And in that regard, the trial court seemed to say, oh, no, you never buy that kind of insurance. That's not the way it works. And you're telling us that there was also testimony of a person who said, I was on vacation and this was handled incorrectly.
That's correct.
On the other side of the equation, though, there is a check that was tendered that did include the damage to the Bennett's property. That being the case, how can the court decide summary judgment?
Well, Your Honor, I think it would be the non-moving party's burden in the court below to establish the disputes of fact. And other than the argument being made in Part 2 here that that was a course of conduct, it was really not a course of conduct because one side was working with knowledge that the other side didn't have and didn't have the right people there. The fact that Philadelphia, and I agree that the Philadelphia policy would cover what is being claimed if the condominium documents required it. I have a copy of the policy. I know what the premium was, but that's all I know. I don't know whether it would have been any different, whether the units are included or excluded. I just don't know from what I could find quickly in my file.
But wouldn't it be important on the record to know what they thought they were purchasing? If we go back to the idea that it's discretionary, you tell us the coverage would apply if the condominium documents say that. You can imagine some exchange that said, well, it was discretionary and we thought we bought it, or it was discretionary, that's not what we thought we were buying.
I the only place you would see that is by implication in Ms. Banks' deposition. She was asked about how much she set aside for various kinds of expenses. And she's the only...
Yeah, but the difficulty for the courts is we have to look at the documents and the regulations, and no matter what most people do, if we have a situation where the documents give you an option to deviate from the norm, now I understand the appellant's argument is the documents are clear, it wasn't discretionary, but for purposes of the oral argument, if we assume that it was discretionary, isn't a real issue in the case what did they buy in the exercise of discretion?
It could have been, Your Honor, but I don't believe it was ever a development of an argument by the plaintiffs in the court below. They relied upon what they believed was clear language in the documents,
but
which was disagreed.
But one way to read the record is when the check was tendered, as you know, Justice Berger mentioned, we're no longer talking about the coverage applying. We're talking about the measure of damages. And so that's the appellant's argument, that we were over whether or not there's coverage. Where this fell apart is simply on damages, not coverage.
Well, if I may go back, that's basically what then Master Glasscock said when he wrote his recommendation that the case be dismissed, is that this is a damage case that belongs in the Superior Court, and the Chancellor signed off without objection. In a question way back about whether or not Philadelphia needs to be here is probably true, because as you've heard, if the court decides to affirm Judge Bradley that there was no obligation to purchase the coverage, then that has an impact on the remaining portion of this case, which is the Bennett's, Ms. Gross, USAA, and Philadelphia, that's still down in the court below. That, and I'm not aware of the status because I've been dropped off the service on that.
Are you telling us this is an interlocutory appeal?
No, no. I asked it to have the summary judgment in favor of my clients certified under Rule 54.
I think the problem, at least from a procedural point of view, is that we have a decision by the trial court that there is nothing in the master documents that requires the condominium association to purchase property casualty insurance for the units. That may be correct, but does it follow from that that summary judgment should have been entered in favor of your clients when there's at least something on the record that may suggest a fact dispute that on the issue of whether the association in fact is part in its discretion acquired that insurance?
I guess it goes back, should the Wilgus and the Plantations have even been parties when the case was transferred over from the Court of Chancery? They were the named parties, but should have been transferred, or should new litigation begun? Should they have only been witnesses in the case that's going to be tried at some time in the future?
Well, that may be an answer to some other question, but it doesn't answer my question.
It may be the answer to your question, Your Honor, because you have to remember what's being asked. The primary argument that this case began with was that the association had an obligation under these documents to repair not only the common elements that were damaged in this flood, but also everything in the Bennett's unit.
Right.
And you've asked about the policies. My understanding from the summary judgments that were argued at the same time as my motion was these losses will be covered by one policy or the other policy or some combination of both of those policies.
Well, what is Philadelphia's position in the court below? Are they saying that we are not required to insure this under the condominium documents, and will they raise that eventually at a trial before the Superior Court?
I spoke to Philadelphia's counsel in the lobby, and I think they've said what we've been saying, that if the condominium documents require coverage, there's coverage. If it doesn't require coverage, there's no coverage. And then the USAA policy comes in because, as I understand the argument,
they don't care.
They didn't ask to intervene. That's about all I can say as to whether they care or don't care.
What seems very strange to me here is this could be a very simple case if the Superior Court judge got it correct when he said the documents don't require coverage, because then that means the underlying policy isn't triggered because it only indemnifies for damage to the contents and to the units in the event the documents require that coverage. But what seems extremely odd to me is that an insurance carrier would tender a check of any kind, regardless of a dispute over the amount of damages, without first determining whether coverage was required or not. I mean, wouldn't they have to look at the documents and make a determination? And didn't they determine that it must have been required, or they wouldn't have tendered the check? Right. Or do we even know?
I don't know. I've been very carefully segregated to representing Wilgus and the Plantations. They have separate counsel for Philadelphia looking at those issues. So I cannot give Your Honor an answer as to why they issued the check. Or why they, it may have been as simple as they just assumed that since the claim was made, it was intended to cover units.
Let's assume Philadelphia ultimately, because the policy volunteered by the condominium association requires coverage, doesn't that moot all of this argument?
I believe Your Honor's correct if that's what happens to the to Philadelphia's position.
Why should we consider this appeal now?
That, as the arguments have developed, that may very well be it, but I had these two clients that were in this case that clearly they did not have they were not going to have a responsibility, and that's why I said earlier I don't believe they're proper parties in the case below. That's why I moved for summary judgment. Their agents and employees may very well be important witnesses in the case below, but that's really should have only been a dispute between the two insurance companies. this, going back to the way this began, it began as a Section 348 action under the Homeowners Association statute. And the Court of Chancery determined that that statute would not be applied to condominium associations because the problem seemed to be much more complex. But that statute would have allowed the Bennetts to be made even completely whole because it's a statute that's provided for attorney's fees if it went into litigation. So I think they wanted to, they were getting different opinions from two different sources. They had this estimate over here of in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. They had a check over here of $24,000. And they said, condominium association, you have to fix our apartment.
Well, procedurally, don't we have an issue of whether final judgment actually should have been entered under Rule 54?
I think it was properly entered based upon the arguments that were made.
Is there a counter argument?
I can understand Your Honor saying maybe we have the cart before the horse here, but it's all, as you can see, it's all highly intertwined as to what the condominium documents mean, because that's going to be decisive, I presume, when Philadelphia and USAA try to figure out what they're going to do with the repairs.
So if we go back to the procedural posture of this case, what you seem to be saying is that if we affirm, for example, and said that there was no obligation to buy insurance, in the litigation that's continuing in the Superior Court, they would then rely on our opinion to say there's no coverage because the documents didn't require it. And then someone may bring up the issue of whether secondary or discretionary insurance was purchased anyway.
Right. And I presume USAA would be the one that would bring up that issue because, as I understand, their policy is written so that it would be excess over any association proceeds that were available. And that would still leave the issue of the discretionary purchase of unit owner coverage to be decided by the court below, but at least allow my clients on the theories that are being espoused against them to be out of this litigation except as witnesses.
Do you know the status of that litigation in the Superior Court?
I do not, Your Honor. I, as I said, I dropped off the service list. I know counsel for Philadelphia is here. I don't know if the court would ask for the status, or I'm assuming the Bennetts know what the status of that case. Mr. Logalay. But I believe the Bennetts are actually in that case, so they should be able to inform the court as to the status.
Any other questions?
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just to clear up the status of the what has been called for years at this point, the sister or companion case to this one, we brought suit against the USA based on the contractual limitations of bringing suit in the policy. It was a belt suspenders approach. At no time have the Bennetts, or in my legal opinion myself, thought that USA was a primary, provided primary coverage to this insurance. It's very clear they paid secondary. The items in the controlling documents I've talked about, which again I believe clearly indicate coverage for my clients, also indicate that any other insurance, additional insurance purchased by unit owners would pay secondary, but my suit against USAA, which is still ongoing at this point, is basically that there is no primary insurance because the condominium association, as well as their property manager, as well as their insurer, have refused to pay us. Therefore,
so did USA bring in Philadelphia? Is Philadelphia in your case now?
It was, and I believe that was done by the court below in its decision on summary judgment to clean up any possibility that the policy issued to the condominium by Philadelphia did include on their own voluntarily coverage for the unit owners.
But it was leave to amend your complaint to bring in Philadelphia. Did you ask for that?
I did, Your Honor. And that was in the transfer from Chancery Court to Superior Court.
So it's happened. You filed an amended complaint against Philadelphia.
Correct, Your Honor.
Where does that all stand now in the Superior Court?
That was, Philadelphia was added in the amended complaint in the transfer, for lack of jurisdiction, from Chancery to Superior Court. Philadelphia indemnity was added in as a co-defendant with Wilgus.
Do you have a trial date? Or is there something else going on in that case?
There was just a, I believe, a request for continuance by Philadelphia Indemnity Insurance Company because they were brought into the USA suit late. So I believe it was going to be May 4th, and now it's going to be at a later date because Philadelphia...
A later date means there is currently no trial date set.
There may be, I'm not sure, Your Honor. As far, I don't, if, and if it is, I don't know what it is, but it is not, it's going to be later than the original trial date set.
Is there an issue, a procedural issue, whether final judgment should have been entered under Rule 54?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Did you agree, oppose? What was your position?
There has not been a position yet for my client.
Well, how did it happen?
Well, we appealed immediately upon a decision because basically they dismissed, or excuse me, they, the court below dismissed our claims against the material defendants, who is the condominium complex, and we immediately appealed within the time frame to appeal.
So you don't contest the position that this is a final judgment that's ripe for consideration on appeal?
Not at all, Your Honor.
Anything else?
May I be excused?
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. Take the case under advisement and recess.